Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
It started out like a song. We started quiet and slow, with no surprise. And then one morning I woke to realize we had a good thing going.
Well, hello, everybody.
Well, hello, folks.
We are coming to you today, obviously, in celebration of the wonderful Stephen Joshua Sondheim, who left this earth on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, which I feel
91 years old.
91 wow. years old. What a life. What a legacy. But I love that in true Sondheim fashion, it was like within 24 hours of good, there was 24 hours of bad. I feel
that
just fit him to a T. And it came at, you know, I think usually when people of that age pass away, there's a couple of days or weeks of warning that things are starting to wrap up. And this was not the case with him at all.
We just got a text from our friend Carl Danielson, who was at the theater seeing Dana H. And what's the matinee that was?
Is this a room?
Is this a room? Yeah. And he was like, he's here. We're right across the aisle. I mean, that was like a week ago, I want to say that he was.
Yeah, that was on Saturday. And then Sunday he did an interview with the Times.
Yeah.
And then
Paulson.
Yeah. And then Friday he left us. And so we felt it was appropriate to do an episode in celebration of him and to talk about all the other shows that that have changed our lives that he was some way involved with. And first of all, I want to start off by saying I did not realize so many people knew the man's address.
Boy, I mean, I phone books, you know, were around, but it's so everybody, I mean, everyone had a New York phone book. I mean, everybody was able to find his address on 49th Street. Unbelievable. It was so many letters.
What's amazes me about him, and this is, I still am amazed by this, is this was a guy who changed the face of musical theater, who did not need to help anyone. And somehow had time to write every single person who wrote to him with a thoughtful letter. None of those letters ever seemed dismissive.
Question.
Yes.
Do you remember the first time? Because I remember the first time I met someone who had a correspondence with him. Do you remember the, you know, when you first did? Like, mine was in college. It was like the year 1999. And this guy who was a composer in school, he like on a whim wrote him. And I'll never forget when he got the letter back. And he, you know, it was a short and sweet letter, but it was from Stephen Sondheim. I mean, it was on that same white paper that everybody has typed, that everybody has, you know. But it blew my mind. Blew my mind that you could reach out to somebody.
I did not realize until I think I got to the city that this was something that was common.
Mm-hmm.
I just assumed that you would write him and some secretary would, you know, write back, Mr. Sondheim, thanks you, or, you know, if you got a response at all. But the fact that he was so detailed in his responses to people, I think that just goes to underline what his whole life was about, which was teaching. He was a brilliant teacher.
Brilliant.
And
absolutely.
I mean, you can watch all of those master classes that are on YouTube. And folks, if you don't know what we're talking about, in the 1980s, he did a master class series in London where he taught people, or coached, I should say, people through songs like My Friend from Sweeney, Getting Married Today, Send in the Clowns. And I'll be honest with you.
Later.
Yes. Those singers are not the strongest singers through vocal technique. Right. That man does not care. He only cares about the storytelling.
The communication,
And it would have been so easy for him to make a snide little comment about their vocal prowess or to put them down because they were not great musicians. He had a smile on his face because it was all about teaching. And I think which I'm assuming he learned from Oscar Hammerstein.
Oh, yeah.
As a protege.
Definitely.
And he continued that tradition. And I'm so hoping that the people that he mentored will continue that tradition. I kind of have a feeling someone like Lin-Manuel Miranda will, but to keep that door open. I mean, I will be honest with you. I have worked with a lot of composers that are nowhere near the orbit of Mr. Sondheim, that have a chip on their shoulder and are as arrogant as can be and charge for their advice and time. You can do that. It's a free country. But the way that Mr. Sondheim did it, I think, is just so classy and so wonderful.
Yeah, exactly. And this is a handed down art form, I believe. I
mean, you are correct.
This is a trade. This is something that, sure, you can go to school and you can study all the basics and all of that. But I think the real craft of it is something that must be, you know, experienced and learned from someone who has lived those shoes. Now, it doesn't mean you're going to copy their style or their writing. That's composition is completely different. Which chords you want to use, which melodies, you know, make you spin. But I think that the craft of it is something that should be handed down. And the fact that he reached out to so many people, the people that got, you know, some success because of it, and then the people who went on into different things in their life, and yet that certainly, I'm sure, had an impact. You know, their education they learned from him in whatever what they do with it for a living, whether it be writing or producing or whatever that may be. But he passed it on, and you're right. I think I'm sure that other writers will be doing that as well, like people like Lin-Manuel and stuff. God, I wish we had Jonathan Larson alive still, because that Tick, Tick, Boom and seeing, you know, their representation of Stephen Sondheim in that movie, which was very reverent in sort of their take on him, as it should be. But it really kind of, he was everywhere. He was just everywhere.
He was everywhere, and he put his money where his mouth was. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, he knew that it was not easy to get into this business. It was not easy to make a living in this business. He had the Young Playwrights Festival. I'm sure we'll find out that there is money left over to go to new writers or to start a new foundation or something. I would not be surprised if that did not happen. I'm sorry. I would be surprised if that didn't happen is what I should say. And he was just this very, very special individual. And I'm so happy that you said that this is a passed down art form, because one of it's a little pet peeve of mine, but I have two pet peeves. I'll tell you what they are. One is somebody using someone's first name when they don't know them. So, like, I used to have a friend who used to say, oh, you know, John and Freddie would say blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, who the hell are John and Freddie? And he goes, oh, Kander and Ebb. It's like, you know them? No, that's a pet peeve of mine. So I met Mr. Sondheim a few times, but I would never dare to call him Steve or Steven. You had a working relationship with him. You call him whatever the hell you want. But I'm like, Mr. Sondheim. My second pet peeve, though, are I see so many people that go into like musical theater writing programs and they're being taught by people who've never written a musical or have only done like one thing, or read books like How to Write a Musical by someone at the University of Nowhere. And you're like, what do you know about it?
Yeah, so it's academic.
It's academic. So the fact that somebody who was in the trenches like Mr. Sondheim, who then took time he did not need to spend to train other people and to mentor other people and to guide other people, I think is incredible. I am sure I'm sure he's a human being. I'm sure he had good moments and bad moments. I have never heard anything incredibly negative about him. Honestly, I've never heard any sort of story of, oh, well, you know, he was an asshole about blah, 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 or the way he treated blah, blah. I have never heard those stories.
I can't say I have either. I'm trying to think now. And if anything, he was like that one letter that went around where he was like, "Dear so and so, no, you may not put together Sudden the Clowns and Baby Shark. Regards, Stephen Sondheim." Like, he still even like replied to that, which is kind of crazy.
Although I will say, I think that was a mistake on his end.
Yeah,
I
mean, it really could have been something big.
The fact that he did not see that, and he had such a good self-deprecating sense of humor. He's like, and now Send in the Clowns, a medley of all my hits.
Yes.
And it's, I mean, what I also loved about him, and I think this is something that it lacks a little bit in other writers or good. Let me go back. One of the things I really enjoy about him, I should say, is that his enthusiasm for the art form of musical theater never wavered. I was watching an interview with him and Barbara Cook. Mm-hmm. And the moderator asked Barbara Cook, what show of yours did you enjoy the most? mm-hmm. be a part of. And she actually hesitated. And she was like, she goes, the only one I can really think of is The Music Man, because it challenged me. And it was nice to be in a hit. Mm-hmm. And then she was like, oh, and you could see like Sondheim like starting to like move in his seat, like he wanted to say something, but didn't want to intrude. And then she was like, well, I think also, you know, she loves me. And he's like, oh, good. He's like, he goes, I would imagine that singing those great songs 8 times a week would be amazing. And blah, 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 blah. And he goes, and I really love this song that Jerry and Sheldon cut that, you know, Vanilla Ice Cream replaced. And I really want you to sing that. And like, it was so fun to watch him be enthused. And I think you have a story about going to his house.
Yeah, like, some of them are like, I never share them unless, like, we have once or twice on the podcast. But, you know, people's anecdotes are like dreams. Like, you really don't need to hear about it unless it's, like, really, you know, poignant. But it was simple. I mean, we you know, he would host parties. If you were in a show of his on Broadway or off Broadway, I think, he would host a party at his house with the band and the cast. And so for Little Night Music, it's only a cast of 15 or 16, a band of like 7. So it was a small, nice, intimate party. Everybody came, of course. And, you know, you went to the door. He greeted you when you rang the doorbell. He took your coat. He, you know, he welcomed you in. But by the end of the night, a lot of people had left. I stayed. And I found myself with him, next to him. And I was he collects records. He collects puzzles and all that. But on his office, he had just, like I have, like, hundreds of records of musicals. And I said to him, I observed that you alphabetize them by composer, not by title, like most people do. But in the classical world, opera and such, you do it by composer. And he said, well, Kevin, it's because I think of the music first. That's how that's how I associate with musicals. And it rocked my world. And then me being the cheeky little 30-year-old musical theater nerd that I was, I tried to think of the most obscure musical I could, you know, be like, well, what if you want to listen to Nefertiti is what came out of my mouth. And without even skipping a beat, Rob, he was like, oh, yes. David Spangler did the music. Christopher Gore did the lyrics. S. Spangler. And then he like mentioned a song in the second act that maybe needed a little revising that he thought he could, you know, have a better lyric. And so I guess the takeaway was that this is a person who is the best at what he does, or, you know, one of the most gifted, a pioneer. And yet he is as big a fan or bigger fan than anybody else. It's not a coincidence he writes good stuff. He is was actively seeking out every writer there was. Even a production of a 1977 musical in Chicago that never came to New York, of this musical about Nefertiti, and how wild and random. And he also mentioned that his classical, because he loves classical music, and he said that he would I think I asked him about, you know, how he gets ideas or writing ideas. And he said that when he was really younger, he would send away for records from small countries and the most lesser known, you know, contemporary classical writers, unknown writers, that he could get their new ideas. Because a lot of times those are the people that were coming up with new harmonic ideas and ways of playing with melody and the different layers that goes into music. And he's like, and if you steal from everybody, then it's like you make your own. But if you just steal from one person, then that's stealing. But he's like, I would take their ideas and get inspiration from that. And I thought that was just amazing that he was a sponge constantly for new ideas, new musical motifs, new ways of creating or contributing to musical theater, you know, and elevating it to a new level. I mean, it was tireless. And I remember I snuck up to his office because the apartment was like open. And he has that main office on the second floor that everyone knows, where the piano is, where they had the fire many years ago. But then up above is like his office, which was like a big workroom where he probably wrote all of his letters and stuff. And I remember thinking it was like a whole room just with paper stacked everywhere and scores and letters and just like a business room, like a room for business, not just, a desk, but just many desks. And I remember just being overwhelmed by the fact that this person takes what they do for a living. I mean, like, it's not just like, oh, I wrote a couple shows and that's it. But it's the active ingredient of corresponding, writing back, keeping that momentum moving forward, I guess, with the art form. And it was really impressive that he was both a sponge for it and put it forward, you know. So I think that's really something.
Do you remember the first time you discovered his music, just as a young actor or as a young person?
Actually, I do, because when I was like 14 in 1994, we had a really great, just like so many people that we've interviewed, we had a great high school director, you know, theater person that came in and did really cool work. And one of the first musical I ever did ever at high school was A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum. I played Hysterium. And that was my first
introduction
to. Yeah. Yep, I'm calm, I'm perfectly calm, I'm utterly under control. Oh yeah, loved it. And that was the first time I really sort of got that this was different than Grease. This was different than, or I grew up watching Peter Pan, the musical with Mary Martin. That was like or Bye Bye Birdie, you know, that there was another level of wordplay, comedy. And I don't even think I appreciate it the way that I do now, of course, but I knew that this was a special person. And of course, just like everyone in our generation, I remember the first time I ever watched Into the Woods on VHS, and I remember watching Sunday in the Park, you know. I remember not getting all of it, but it still being so magical and a really indelible impression. What about you? When was the first time you really hit him in your orbit?
I think, you know, it's interesting. My mother was a very big theater fan, and her favorite show was Sweeney Todd. And
oh, really?
So, yeah. And so I got introduced to that at a very early age.
Yeah.
And so that, I think that she used to use Not While I'm Around as a lullaby to me. And oh, so God. That, so I got introduced that way. Then, of course, then I found out what the hell the show was about. And you're like, oh,
thanks, look,
this is creepy. To say the least. I started to really explore his, it was very interesting. I came to his music in sort of a backwards way, which was hearing individual songs first and then finding out the show from which they came.
Mm-hmm.
The big thing I remember for me was I did not grow up with the Into the Woods movie the way I think everybody else did. What I did grow up with, because it was like the only theatrical thing available at the local video store, Video for You on Moore Park Road, now closed, now it's a yoga studio. The pornography section was in the back, and I always saw the guy from church there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I was like, that's the priest. Was they had the VHS of Follies in Concert.
Oh.
And so I would watch that continuously. That was my way in. And then I don't know if you remember Bravo, before it was reality television, was the artsy channel.
The It Factor was one of my favorite shows from like 2000, where they followed like seven actors around
yes,
New York City.
God,
it was
Godfrey,
during 9/11 because yes,
he became
yes.
a 7-Up. He was the guy. He did 7-Up commercials, and I just worked with
Jimmy Smagula, who's
yes,
still
Jimmy. Yes. Yes, I worked at a theater a couple of years ago, and Jimmy and I were both directing shows, and I got so starstruck.
Oh yeah,
and I was like, I really hate to bother you.
Daisy Egan was also, I think.
I think she was on it. The It Factor. They should do a reunion of that show and see what the hell happened to those people.
God, I love that. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, but if you remember, Bravo was like the intellectual channel. And yeah. I remember they did an Inside the Actor's Studio with Stephen Sondheim. And I watched that, and I was like, I don't know really that much about him. And then hearing his process, this was an old one, because it had James Lipton without his beard or his pretentiousness. So that was that was a very old one.
Just a stack of cards.
Just a stack of cards. And that changed my life, because to hear him explain what songwriting was, then I remember there's another channel. I think it's still on. It's like the Arts Channel. It's that thing that comes on like in the middle of the night. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, where they play like different things.
I love that channel, actually.
And they kept playing over and over again a Weekend in the Country that was done at the 92 Sondheim Carnegie Hall.
Yes.
And I was like, what is this? I didn't know what the fuck the show was about. Mm-hmm. And that was the thing, which was, for me, I didn't know what the shows were about, but I would hear the songs get mentioned in the song titles, and I didn't know what they were until I actually, like, years later, delved into the actual
right.
album. But I remember my most transformative Sondheim experience, and I don't think a song has touched me as much since, is Sunday, the actual song Sunday, like everybody else. But I have a very distinct memory getting the CD from the library.
Ah, yes.
And it was like the summer between my freshman and sophomore year of high school, I think, on a hot summer night, like 2 a.m. in California. I couldn't sleep. And I listened to Act One, and I'll never remember just like getting to that song for the first time and just crying. Mm-hmm. Just, I'm not an artist. Like, I'm not a visual. I don't do that. You know, it's about some French painter who lived 100 years ago. But just being so touched by the beauty of it. So that's my memory. Now, how many Sondheim shows have you been involved in some capacity? Or which ones have you done? You did Forum?
Forum, yep. And then freshman year of college, we did Mary Lee, we rolled along. The original. She got
Hills of Tomorrow.
The original script, yes, Beyond the Hills of Tomorrow, yes. None of those were in there.
What do you... I hate to interrupt, but I have to ask you, because I know people get very opinionated about this. Do you prefer the Hills of Tomorrow opening, closing, or do you prefer the Rich and Happy...
I do, but I think it's because that thing that happens when you did something that was like really big when you were 18, 19, and you think that was the foundation of your art. So like, it's hard to separate my intellectual, you know, analyzation of the show versus my experience being in it when I was 18 and thinking, how amazing is this? And I loved it. I absolutely loved that version of it. And yes, definitely. So I would prefer the original. And I think
you prefer Hills of Tomorrow.
The more they tinkered with it, the more it got a little gussied up, if you will.
Oh, there he is, folks, using puns. Okay, who were you in Merrily?
I was the young protege who was like at the piano during. I think they cut it in the original later versions. That's why. That's probably why.
They got rid of your part.
Like, but it was like bum 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 bum, trying to be the new writer in the Rich and Happy, or you know, the life is swinging.
This, yeah,
you know,
the skies opening. Are blue and bells are ringing.
Party dun 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 dun. And I had like a little solo in that, and that was really it. That was all I had. But in ensemble, you know, it's a hit and all of that.
And then.
I don't think I've ever done Company, Into the Woods. Now I'm music directing it right now, actually. And we did Merrily together. But as far, I don't think I've ever, I was Rapunzel's Prince in a production of Into the Woods, in regional theater.
Yeah. I saw a picture of that go by on Instagram.
Yeah. Sorry.
You gave us cheekbones. It was great.
That's right. No, I think that's really it. I think, you know, we did like scenes, like Barcelona was my scene in college and stuff like that. What about you? I know that you worked on concerts when you worked with Lonnie Price. The Sondheim concert.
My first Sondheim was I did Into the Woods in high school. Mm-hmm. Like everybody does. I was the narrator, Mysterious Man.
Yeah, you were.
And Danny Lincoln, who's a former colleague of ours, was my baker.
Wow.
So Danny and I have known each other for a long time now, 20 years. Oh, no, sorry. I said it was in high school. So Danny and I have known each other for 5 years. God, it's quick. Get me Botox. I was the narrator / Mysterious Man. Perfect for me. Right for that vocal range. Not a singer.
Yep.
Fit
there you
that
go.
Pocket. Then in college, don't know why we did this in college, I was like 21 and we were doing Company. So I did Company in college, a god-awful production of Company in which they turned Ladies Who Lunch into a dance number.
You're lying.
Oh, no.
No way.
It was a dance number with two waiters. She danced with two waiters and the two waiters came out and danced with like martini shakers. I'm not joking.
Kind of changes the whole vibe of the song a little bit, but.
Oh, sure, my God. It was one of those shows where even then I was like, what the fuck is happening? I played Harry, the karate couple.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget. I was like, I think this was the director in me. The actress who played my wife was a very good friend of mine. And she was like, okay. She goes, well, for the karate scene, she goes, I want to be safe. Amazing. And she's like, I think I should bring out a karate mat.
Oh.
And so like she dragged out a karate mat for, and like then unfolded the karate mat. This was during the show for us to do the karate on. And I'll never forget. I was like, we're losing the comedy. I was an easy actor to work with, but I was like, I think that was the director in me. I'm like, we're losing the comedy.
Come on. We gotta
I was like, I
this.
Said, I'll, I said, I don't mind throwing myself on the floor. It's okay. But I was so angry. I was like, we're losing the comedy.
And that's when Rob became a director, folks. That's
I think it really is, because I was like, I don't know what the fuck is happening. Then in college, for our senior year, we did Candide. And I was in Candide. I played, oh God, it's the character that's like, it was in the London version. I don't know if he's in the other versions. He's the one who sings "The Worst of All Possible Worlds."
No.
What the hell? Don't make me laugh. Don't make me titter. Life is all chaff. All pills are bitter. Nothing can happen in this worst of all possible worlds. Something like that.
Oh, right.
Yeah. I don't know if they do it. And I wanted to play Pangloss.
Of course you did. That's your resume, really.
Can I tell a story?
Go for it.
And I'll be real quick. They brought in this actor to play Pangloss at the college who was a community theater actor who couldn't memorize any of his lines. And so they used to give him a book as Pangloss to hold, which was his script. And I'll never forget. This is a true story. You can ask anybody who was in this production.
Okay.
At the end of Act One, he was supposed to step forward and say, 15 minutes blackout, like it's intermission.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Opening night, I swear to God, he looks out and goes, 5 minutes. And we're like, what? And we scrambled like mofos because we could see through the curtain. No one was getting up because they thought, oh, it's like a 5 minute stretch break. And so we're like, Ken, I shouldn't use his name, but I was like, Ken, like, it's not 15 minutes. I mean, it's not 5 minutes. It's 15 minutes. He used to talk to me. Yes. Okay. All right. Next performance. Swear to God. Intermission. He goes, 25 minutes.
It's not the opera.
We're like, write it down, Ken. It's in the book, Ken. So I did Candide. In grad school, I directed Company.
Nice.
I directed Company with a concept because I love concepts.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on S.E. Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
I did Merrily with you. Mm-hmm. I did Merrily with you. And then I did, when I first moved to the city, I was Lonnie Price's assistant on Sweeney Todd at Lincoln Center. And he was present for those rehearsals towards the end. And this to me was the most eye-opening thing I think I've ever learned about an artist, because here was a guy who could have been so precious with something and just was like, do what you want.
Yeah.
He's like, he would say, I wouldn't do it like that, but it's your, you know, it's you do you. I'll never forget, on a break, he pulled Audra aside, Audra McDonald. And he said, he goes, come here. And she's like, yes, Steve. And he goes, if you want, here in the opening, he goes, you're taking a little breath here and it's going to ruin the joke. He's like, but he's like, if you want, he goes, you can take a breath here and you'll still get the laugh for the momentum. He's like, but you do what you want. He goes, she goes, I'll do what you want, Steve. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I think you'll get a bigger payoff there. This guy could have gone up and said, hey.
There was always a reason, though. Like, it wasn't just, oh, I wrote it this way, so do it this way. But, you know, I've told this many times. My little experience recording a little night music, there was a section I sang that, you know, you know, sometimes things morph a little bit as you do a show, a long run. And I had started sort of reinterpreting one of the phrases. The evening air doesn't feel quite right. And I was going, the evening air doesn't feel. So it wasn't as laid out. And he was like, Kevin, I think you'll see I wrote even quarter notes here because, and he could have just left it like that, like just sing what's on the page. But he was like, because it's hypnotizing. The sun's not setting and we're setting this mood that it's transfixing, it's hypnotizing. And so not only did he give you like, do it right, but he also was like, and here's the reason why I wrote it this way, you know? And I just think that is so amazing that even across the board, he was like that, that there was, it was always about the storytelling, like we said from the very beginning of this episode, but that he was always those deep, like that's one of his three mantras, right? God is in the details. Like it is all about those tiny little moments that add up, don't they?
God is in the details.
Yes.
Always be a teacher. And I think I can get a coupon for this. He was really good at finding Groupon. A good bargain. He was a big Groupon guy. That's one of the reasons why he didn't write as much in his later years, because somebody was like, hey, have you seen Groupon? And then he just spent all of his time being like,
constantly
hey,
buying.
Telling his husband, you know, if we go kayaking in Colorado, I have a 2-for-1. That's all I kept looking at was clipping those things. I think that's such a great testament to him of very easy. I mean, I've worked with new writers where it's like, can we change? No, it's what I wrote. Okay. And here he is. Here he is, the greatest of all time, saying, do what you want. Like, you know, if I were you, I would try it like this.
Yeah, you'll find this is probably going to work better, but.
Yeah, but, and I mean.
Yeah. And it does. And he's right. And I mean, he's like, right. He's almost always right, isn't he?
He's right. I also loved, you know what I was obsessed with? Do you remember the New York Times thing? I think it's 20 years old now.
Of course.
Songs I wish I had written.
Yes.
There's
playlists on Spotify. You can like find.
Oh, really?
People curated that. Oh, yeah.
One of the things I always wanted to do, but we couldn't make it work, was I wanted him to do it at 54 Below. Yeah. And to pick like 13 of those songs and have people sing them, but him give the commentary on why he wanted to write that really? Song. And it never was able to work itself out. But I was like, that could be so much fun if he had done that. Yeah. Thank God he left us two fantastic books.
Great books.
You know, and I think one of the questions that I know we get a lot is how come he was never a guest on our show, And I think, tell the story.
Well, we wrote to him. I mean, I wrote to him.
Tell a story, Kev.
Tell a story, Kev. No, we wrote to him, it was a Sunday evening, and I was like, I am going to – let's see what happens here. And this was like 4 years ago, so it was still kind of early on. And I wrote – you know, I gave him like the spiel, and he said, I have the email right here. He said, Dear Kevin Thomas, thank you for the invitation, but I simply have neither the time to babble on anymore about myself. You should have corralled me sooner before I got all talked out. Please forgive me with apologies. And then I tried to push a little harder to say, we'll talk about, you know, mentorship and all that. And he said, it might be fun for you, but not for me. As Comden Green might sing, quote, thanks, but no thanks. I just thought, even then, still a classy rejection letter from a classy man, still quoting his idols and, you know,
but
being sweet about it.
But we did find out that he listens to the show, or he listens.
That was part of the, I think that's what spawned it, actually. We talked to our good friend Michael Levine, and who was, you know, friends with Mr. Sondheim, and I thought, all right, come on, if he listens to us, maybe he wants to be a part of it. But
I always pictured him like listening to us in his bathtub yelling at us.
Yes. Or our guest.
That's not in G. There was one guest who I think told the story about Sondheim yelling at him, and I pictured Sondheim being like, yeah, because you were wrong.
I mean, period. That's
typing really away it. At the typewriter. Click, 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 click.
Writing letters and like talking back to the speaker.
Is there a show of his that's a dream of yours? Like, is there a role that you still want to play, or a show that you'd want a music direct of his?
I'm fast growing out of, but I think Company is a beautiful show, and I would love to.
What do you mean growing out of it? Antonio Banderas is playing it right now in Spain.
That's
maybe
right.
You need to-
he's like, that's a really good question. It's not his score, but A Gypsy remains one of my top, you know, like Desert Island musicals for sure.
To be in or to music direct?
To just be a part of somehow. Yeah. Either be in or to music direct. I would just like want to be a part of it. Cause I feel like we've been really lucky that, you know, I've been able to do a lot of them. I still love Little Night Music. I still think that is just a beautiful show. And I did it for a year and a half and I never got tired of it.
Show that I don't listen to a lot for some reason in my cast album rotation. And I don't know why, but on Thursday, the day before he died, I was like, I'm going to listen to a Little Night Music. And I sat down and I put it on. I was like, God damn, this is so good.
It is. And the book is good. That a lot of people, when they saw it, they were like, I didn't know it was so funny. It's funny. It's really funny.
It is a very funny book. Do you have a favorite Sondheim song or lyric?
I was thinking about this because I knew we were going to probably ask this of each other. And I don't want to say I do, but it's hard to... You either love him because he's so clever or because he's, the hands on the clock turn, but don't sing a nocturne just yet. I mean, that's just a really witty, that's smart. It's clever. But as far as heartfelt, I must tell you, doing Into the Woods right now with my students. I did it a couple years ago where I was in it and I thought, oh, this is good. I like it. It's pretty. Like the ending is so, it's so sweet. Now that I have a 2.5-year-old son and now when I get to the end of it, and when they get to the children will listen, destroys me. It destroys me because the idea that the baker has to go on with life now with his as a single parent and that he's going to like pass this on to his kid. And one of the things that, and this is not answering your question, but it sort of is because I would probably cite that now in my life, but I don't understand how this person could, with all of these different kinds of shows, they just saw Assassins and he humanized these people in Assassins, but how he could reach the core of a certain human existence that, like, until I had a son, there's no way I could have understood and appreciated what that feeling is like. How in the world did this person not only write lyrics but music to go with it so that together they make me want to weep because of it's so true and it's so spot on, and this is someone who famously really didn't know love in his life until later on in his life, and so how was he able to write about it so deeply in Sweeney Todd and The Little Night Music and, all these other shows? That part will always forever astound me, that he could capture the human existence that wasn't his, that he could just imagine and come up with. So the short answer is children will listen.
I think that's beautiful. I think that's absolutely beautiful. It's a good choice.
Yeah. What about you?
And his I asked the question, I should have known the answer. I mean there are so many. Of course it's I don't want to say it's cliche, but I love it from Sunday.
Everybody loves.
No, I do like Everybody Loves Louie. Oh my God, why am I having a brain fart? It's anything you do, let it come from you, then it will be new. Give us more to see. I couldn't speak it. I could only sing it.
That's okay. Good. Yeah. Move on.
Move on.
Yeah.
No, beautiful. but that particular passage.
That lyric, yes.
Yeah.
Totally.
I think Comedy Tonight is genius. My favorite, though, this is so, it's so odd, but I was like, to me, I'm like, what a brilliant, I love subtext. And I think the best example of subtext in a musical theater composition is in Buddy's Eyes.
Mm. Yeah.
Because
Ollie's, well, yeah.
It's a woman talking to this guy who, had she gone with him, her life would have been different. And she's trying to convince herself. She's telling him, hey, everything is fine in my life. But it's clear she's trying to convince herself. And I love that it gets like a little passive aggressive. Because it starts off like life is slow, but it seems exciting because Buddy's there. Gourmet cooking and letter writing and knowing Buddy's there. Every morning, don't faint. I tend the flowers. Can you believe it? And what I love about that opening is I am sure when they were dating, she had dead plants in the house.
Yep.
You know what I mean? Like that she couldn't take care of anything. And now look at me, I'm a gardener. Yeah. And then it's every weekend I paint for umpteen hours, and then it like it sort of it changes on you. And yes, I miss a lot living like a shut-in. No, I haven't got cooks and cars and diamonds like your wife does. Yes, my clothes are not Paris fashions like your wife's, but in Buddy's Eyes, I'm young, I'm beautiful. And there's something about that I just go, That is so fucking genius. He totally encapsulates the past 25 to 30 years that these two people have not seen each other.
And all the depth that's there.
And
all of the layers and specific, you know, moments that add up to a life. Yeah. That's why I think Follies, the older you get in life, your relationship with that show changes as well, because there's so many different layers going on there
with life
and relationships and all that. Totally.
And when we talk about overtures, I know people are like, oh, the Gypsy Overture is the best overture. The Funny Girl, the Carousel, it's Follies.
Oh, I was going to say Merrily. Merrily is like one of my favorite overtures.
Yes. Okay, great.
I love that. I love Merrily. But Follies. Come on. That's crazy. That's super good.
Either way, we're both in Sondheim land, which is totally, totally fine for both of us. I think, you know, I would love to hear from people about their memories, their first time seeing a Sondheim show, if they had interactions with him, if they wrote him a letter, did he write back? Yeah. And I think it's a great, you know, thank God he got celebrated so much in his lifetime.
Totally.
And he was able to see it.
That's right.
Sadly, Jonathan Larson will not see Tick, Tick, Boom, but Stephen Sondheim got to see all of the wonderful things that he has done for people being rewarded. I mean, every year there was a birthday concert.
Yes. And the fact that he, you know, he's got, you know, famously he's very not strict, but has control over his shows, you know, and when you do them and who can do them. But also, you know, with his company Revival was like, yeah, let's change it up. Let's play with this a little bit here. Let's see how we can, you know, change and move with a little bit with the times and see what we can find here. I mean, this is someone who was definitely, you know, tried to keep this finger on the pulse of what is art and where the art, you know, transforms. And I think that's also very, very impressive that he was
not precious, present.
Yeah,
absolutely right. Absolutely. And, you know, and what I love about him is, like you said, he's willing to take risks on his own material.
Yeah.
Do you remember this? They did this a few years ago. Remember when they did a reading? It didn't go anywhere beyond a reading, but an all male company.
I do.
And Alan Cumming was like the Joanne character. I think Roundabout did it. And he was like, no, not going to work. But it was like wonderful that I think he probably felt like it wasn't going to work. But who was he to say, don't try it?
Right. Yeah. Sure.
Sure. Go for it.
Yeah.
I'm sad we'll never get to see Square One.
I know.
I'm assuming there's music from it. I'm sure people would love to get their hands on it in some way. Shape or form, but an amazing legacy that he leaves behind.
Yes.
And so that's us celebrating the great Stephen Joshua Sondheim. Please share your memories with us on social media. And I feel like one of the things Sondheim did brilliantly was the promotion of new works and supporting new artists. So I feel like I have to do a little new works plug if I can. It's not even a new work. Do you know what I saw a couple of days ago? Trouble in Mind. With LaShawn's and former guest Chuck Cooper at Roundabout.
Yes.
A play that was written in the 1950s.
Right.
By a woman named Alice Childress, who this play feels like it could have been written today. It's the story of Black actors working in a show helmed by white people.
Mm-hmm.
And how that conflict sets itself out, and what exactly is the role of race and color in a rehearsal setting in a theatrical environment. LaShawn's is great. And we have always tried to get her as a guest, but I feel like we should just try even harder now because her performance is absolutely amazing. So this is one of those rare, rare plays that was written years ago, but feels like it was written today. It is a marvelous, marvelous play that Roundabout is doing. So please, friends, if you're in the area, go see Trouble in Mind, starring LaShawn's, and former guest, Chuck Cooper.
Good old Chuck Cooper.
His performance, is incredible. just incredible. I will be honest with you, the first act is very expository. So it takes a while to figure out exactly what the conflict is going to be. Then act two comes along and it just punches you in the gut. And LaShawn's is genius, but Chuck Cooper especially has a beautiful, beautiful monologue. So please, friends, go see Trouble in Mind at Roundabout. And you've only got another week or so to see like a lot of our former guests in Mornings at 7. With Tony Roberts, Alma Cuervo, John Rubenstein, pretty much anyone who's been on our show shows up in this. It's a brilliant, beautiful production. And given a totally inappropriate review from the New York Times, they have this critic over there, and I don't think she likes theater. Like, I don't know what else to say. Like, but people, you know, I don't know. I have no idea. But wasn't for her. I could not disagree more. So please don't go by the Times review. Go by the smiles on people's faces and go see Mornings at 7. I know that you've been busy. Have you been able to see anything?
I did. I saw Assassins the day after.
Oh, how was it?
Some really incredible performances. I love they orchestrated it with more of like that sort of, you know, John Doyle production. A lot of the actors play instruments, but I really loved the flavor. It was a sort of a patriotic sort of Americana kind of sound. And I like that kind of folky is the word I think I might use to like, you know, and I like the orchestration.
I am so curious. The last production of Assassins I ever saw was before Columbine and before school shootings became so prevalent. Do they use real guns in this production?
Oh, yeah, and they point them at the audience. Oh,
really?
Yeah.
Do they fire them or the sound effects?
Thank goodness they make a sound effect shot, so it's not a real – because that would be that's too much.
Yeah.
But they do because in classic stage company, it's three quarters thrust stage. So you were like on eye level with them all. And it's like, you know, that's the point, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
So but it didn't become about the guns.
I'm going to see it soon as well, but I'm happy that you got to see it directed by former guest, John Doyle.
That's right. That's right.
Did we have any other former guests in it or was it just him? Probably just him, right?
Put me on the spot.
No. I don't think we did. I don't think we did. We've never had Judy Kuhn on, have we? No.
No, we should.
We should.
But
you should have stopped the show and been like, Judy.
She's really good.
Judy. Handed her our business. Kevin. Handed her our business. You guys did Les Mis together, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You should have stopped her during the scene.
No, and I played the piano. This is a great teacher at the performing arts school. He teaches like first grade you're going to kill me. But he uses musical theater as his technique to teach.
You've talked about him.
And Judy sang, she was a guest and she sang, one of her songs from Pocahontas. And it was so funny because she went up on the lyric and then the kids started singing it for her. Really cute.
That's actually very cute.
Yeah, it was cute.
Well, I'm so happy that we got to touch base today.
Me too, Rob.
That we were both very lucky in the fact that we both got to work with this great man seen his brilliance up close and personal. But it feels like a lot of other people got to do that because his kindness and generosity and desire to teach seem to know no bounds or limitations.
It's the mark of a great teacher, isn't it? That everyone feels like, I had a teacher in college like this, that when she passed, I was so really moved by it. But what was comforting was that all these other people had these other personal experiences of being changed because of this one person. And that one person can do that on a micro level to so many people, you know, and everyone has like a moment that's really magical. That's really, really special that somebody can not only be good at it, but also like teach and educate and change people's lives. And that's just, you're right. It's just so beautiful.
And I think that's maybe why his death has affected us even more. It's not just the brilliant work. It's that we've always known that there was this great man behind it. And I don't mean great just simply in terms of his intelligence and talent, which was great is too simple a word to use for that. But the kindness, generosity, an avid theater goer, a lover of theater. And like you said, the fact that he can say to you, oh yeah, Nefertiti. Yep. Written by this person, this song. Yep. Oh yeah. Watching him during the run-throughs of Sweeney Todd was incredible because you would not find a more ardent supporter of what was going on that stage than that individual.
It's beautiful.
Yeah. And so may we all live our creative lives as openly and freely as Mr. Sondheim did. I hope we all have a vodka stinger tonight to celebrate him. And one, now not one for Mahler, but one for Stephen.
I'll drink to that.
I'll drink to that. All right, my friends, it was so good getting to talk to you. I'm sure we'll talk to you again soon. Yeah. But in the meantime, please send us your recollections of Mr. Sondheim. If you got photos, letters, tweet us, Instagram us, Facebook us. It makes us very, very happy. And wish Kevin Break a Leg on Friday night when Into the Woods opens. If you're in the New York City area, head on over to the Professional Conservatory of Musical Theater at the New York Film Academy, 17 Battery Place, and go see Into the Woods.
You're the best.
You're the best. All right, my friends, take care.
Take care, everybody.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.